Welcome to Worker Movement, a podcast dedicated to the working class, a podcast dedicated to raising class consciousness. This podcast is for you, for us, for the worker.
I feel like I've started every episode with, now that Joe Biden's president, but he really is now. 4,000 people are still dying each day from COVID, and kids are still in cages, but they're not on the news anymore, so it doesn't affect the brunch crowd. Media reporting, or propaganda, has tried the turning the corner framing in recent days, but the vaccination push simply hasn't been sufficient. In the first 45 days of vaccine availability, roughly 25 million Americans have received the first injection, and an additional 5 million the full two-shot regimen. If we do some back-of-the-envelope math, let's assume that 10% of the U.S. population has already been infected. This is about 1.5 times more than the number of confirmed cases. Let's then assume that herd immunity occurs at 70% of the population. In order to supplement the additional 60% of community immunity needed, at the current vaccination rate, this would take approximately 11 months. Does immunity even last that long?
So the question of immunity is a couple things here. It's one, what does it take for the body to respond and create immunity? And does it create T-cell or B-cell immunity? That's the first one. The second is, does the vaccine actually kick off the right immunity for longevity? You know, does it need a first or second part of it? And the third is the amount of different variants coming out going to screw up all of your immunity? Let's start with the first one. So how long do you think it's going to last if they give you the right B-cell immunity? If you actually get COVID, you're sick, you're sick long enough that the T-cells are not the primary way that they destroy it, and you go through the stages of building immunity.
There's some time frame in which your immunity will wane. We aren't attempting to quantify the duration, but there are scientists working on it. From an epidemiological perspective, your immunity will decline over time. That's just how virus immunity works. Whether it's 6 months, or whether it's 12 months, or whether it's 24 months. We don't know, but it has an important impact on how public policy should play out with how vaccines are distributed.
Yeah, so if you get a stable B-cell, your immunity should last at least 8 months. That's from a paper that was published by Monash University, December 23rd, 2020, called Long-Lasting COVID Immunity Gives Real Hope for Long-Term Protection of Vaccines. But you have to get the B-cell. You must get to the B-cell response, or your vaccine or your response is worth diddly squat. Because for those of you not in the know, if you have a T-cell response, it's only really the T-cells that kill and don't actually get long-lasting. So then every time your body gets it, your body starts over again with the response, not knowing what it was before that it was fighting.
So the endpoints that are used for a lot of these vaccine trials are, I get injected twice, 21 days apart, or whatever the acceptable time frame is. And then I'm studied for some period of time after my injections. And if I don't get COVID by the time the study sample ends, I'm marked as the vaccine worked because I didn't get COVID. And then through a large-scale data aggregation, they compare a placebo group and a vaccine group. And through math, you're able to determine what the effective rate of getting COVID was in both groups and draw conclusions about how effective the vaccine was. But in some way, shape, or form, we're not really assessing whether you develop T-cell immunity, which is your first line of immune system response, or you're developing B-cell immunity, which is the long-term antibodies.
So the question is, did you get a response? Did you get the B-cells, the T-cells? And that's if you get COVID and you're sick. Now, the goal of the vaccine is to give you that response, that you get a bunch of immunity, so next time the virus hits your body, you don't get there. So we have competing styles of vaccines that are out there. We have the mRNA, which you're going to see in the Pfizer and the Moderna. Then you have the more traditional, we're trying to inject you with a dead virus, which is AstraZeneca and Sputnik and CoronaVac. And right now, we're having large-scale global trials because they are just speeding through the approval mechanisms and just slamming them into the arms of individuals. So we actually won't know the efficacy rate of all of these until, like, probably summer, in which we get through you know, the first round, phase one in the United States is all of your healthcare workers and people that are very immunocompromised that can handle it. So your elderly, your people living within elderly communities. Phase two are all of your primary, I don't know, economy-driven people that are always going to be exposed, your frontline workers who are not healthcare. So your journalists and your whoever else are out there in the streets every day getting it. And then children 16 and over, I think. And then phase three is pretty much anybody else in the economy and any other older person that needs to get in there. So you're really not going to get through that many vaccinations. 83 million vaccinations is what I think that those groups cover. Until probably May, I'm guessing. It's already end of January and we're not hitting 20 million vaccinations and we had 4 months to go. So unless you're getting 20 million vaccinations a month, you're never going to hit that number.
And then we have the unknown nature of whether there's going to be a mutation or variants. It's just something we don't know. It's not particularly interesting to discuss because it is a very large unknown. You don't make healthcare policy based on hypotheticals generally. If there were to be a mutation that was immune to the vaccine, that would obviously be a setback, and we would have to, in some way, shape, or form, restart the vaccination process. We're going to hope that doesn't happen. But in terms of the vaccine that works today being distributed and what general ramifications are out of that, the potential of a variant is not really actionable.
Right. Yeah, the variant is basically you're hoping that, as one of the puffery pieces from Moderna said, is that there's still some neutralizing capability within the vaccine, which is basically means that you hope that there's some residual effects that give you some ability to fight off the virus some of the time. It's similar to the flu shot. You get the flu shot, they guess the wrong variant, but you hope that your symptoms aren't as bad when you go through the flu because you have some flu vaccine in you.
And this is a very clear attempt by Moderna to issue a positive PR release that says, we did a study and we determined that there's some immunity, but at the same time, we're also going to do a booster shot. So it's like, which one of those is not like the other?
And yeah.
It's fine in the sense that they're doing something, but it's also not fine in that we don't know whether the current vaccines are going to be capable of withstanding a potential variant. We just don't know. But there's really no different course of action we should take. You develop the booster shot and you hope that you get the process down rapidly enough that if something arises, you can distribute the vaccine more quickly or a booster more quickly than has been happening so far.
Yeah, it's how do you weaponize, and I'm saying it that way, or how do you mobilize the entire industry and world to give out vaccines? To me, there shouldn't be a single private practice open that isn't vaccinating. They literally should have seized every medical provider and said, you're giving out vaccines. And if not, you lose your license. Like, that should be a thing. Because there's no reason why CVS should be giving out, we gave out 20,000 shots this month. Look at us. When clearly my primary care doctor could have scheduled an appointment for me, walked in and stabbed me in the arm, and I would have been done. The other part that's really interesting is there it doesn't seem to be a clear consensus on first booster or first shot, second shot, right? There doesn't seem to be any attempt at clarifying, well, if I don't get the second shot, am I still partially protected or am I zero protected at all? That's a very important thing here because, Biden says he's releasing all of the primary, but then there's nothing left over for secondary, but Pfizer's saying they have enough vaccines coming through, but yet we don't see enough vaccines coming through. So I don't know which one it is.
Right. The federal government doesn't seem to have a good grasp of how many vaccines exist and how many will exist at some production rate going into the future. And this creates complexity with everybody needs two shots based on the Pfizer Moderna vaccine to achieve the high 90s efficacy rate. You need one shot and then 21 days later, you need another shot. Whether that 21 days can be stretched to 40 days to 80 days to 200 days and you still achieve the upper 90s efficacy, we don't really know because that's not what the study did. The study said within 21 days plus or minus some day threshold, I don't know what it is, it's in that general magnitude, you need to get your booster shot. And so what Biden has done is said, well, we need to get people vaccinated as quickly as possible, so as many people as possible should get their first vaccine. Now this creates the scenario where everybody gets their first vaccine, then we run out of vaccines, and then people don't get their second vaccine. Is that a good outcome? No.
And can Pfizer make rate? So if you do manufacturing, when you say making rate, that means you said you're going to make X amount of things per day. Can you hit it? And I don't know if they can, because I don't know if all the storage is there. I mean, it's that back to that minus 188 million Rankin system where you have to be below absolute zero in order to keep it cool, right? And then so even the storage itself is a problem because you have to keep it cold and then bring it out, and then you have 2 hours to use it or some nonsensical time to start distributing it. So I don't know if they can make rate. I don't know if it takes 21 days from the first shot and the booster is just a guarantee you have immunity. Or if you were to wait 60 days for the first shot, would you actually have immunity? Because nobody did that trial. Nobody actually did the trial about how long does it take to actually get immunity. They just said, if you give you two shots, shit works, we think, most of the time.
If you're attempting to develop healthcare policy in the U.S. and you know that there are 100 shots, how do you go about prioritizing when the first shot happens and when the second shot happens? We're going to propose a metric. It's very simple. Where, because you need two shots, we're going to say that each shot provides 50% of your expected immunity. You get the first shot, you're 50% immune. We're making these numbers up. They're not based on any studies or anything.
These are hypotheticals.
You're 50% immune. When you get your second shot, you're 100% immune. So that means that you got two shots, and each shot provided 50% immunization efficacy. Now, let's say you get a shot, and then 60 days later, you get another shot. Is that shot on the 60th day, does that provide the second half of your immunity? Let's say it doesn't, because we don't have a study or a trial that says that it does. So let's say it only provides an additional 25% benefit. That means you got two shots, but you're only 75% immune. That means that each shot only had a 37.5% basically immunization effect. That shot was less effective than it could have been. And that's the metric by which we think injections should be determined, is you want to maximize the effectiveness of every single individual shot. And that means that people need to get their second doses in some guaranteed fashion, because that's the best way to maximize that number.
You have to do this. And there's no reason why you want your entire population to walk around with one shot. Just from game theory alone, you'd want a smaller part of the population with two shots. Guaranteed immunity. Not guaranteed immunity, but guaranteed higher immunity. So it doesn't make any sense to me why you'd A, release them, B, promise rate that you can't even hit for injections, and then C, finally, not even entertain the idea of other countries bringing in vaccines. Right? I mean, I don't understand why we're stuck on the fact that we have these new medicines, mRNA, we need to use them, when there's also other technologies out there that potentially offer better efficacy rates than mRNA.
So at an even higher level, the problem is we have five vaccines and we named them, and there's more than that, certainly, but they all generally have a two-shot approach. So you have five different companies effectively manufacturing a single one shot, and then you have five other companies manufacturing a second shot. Why don't you pick one or two vaccines, choose which companies are going to produce what, and then have one company and two company and three company produce the same vaccine, and then have three other companies produce a second vaccine. That way you don't have redundant resources producing five distinct vaccines.
Exactly. Pick the winners and go with them, right? It's not political, but it's been weaponized. It's been politicized. We didn't pick a winner because we picked capital. Capital picked those two. That's it. We can't have any state-funded real vaccinations. We have to have the newest technology, because you're basically a guinea pig now for whether or not mRNA is a viable vaccine for the future. Because they rushed the trials, there are a lot of things that we are finding out now as human guinea pigs of what these vaccines can and cannot do. We know that there may be an increased prevalence of Bell's palsy. We know it's an inflammatory disease. We think, based on our numbers, that there is a statistical probability or significance that the vaccine may cause additional cases of Bell's palsy in the general population. We also believe that there are other allergic reactions or other negatives that come from these vaccines that weren't discovered because the trials did not exist to make sure that every demographic and population was tested with the vaccine. And we're finding this out with all these weird stories about, like, doctor collapses after getting shot. I guess that sounds like he got shot, but doctor collapses after getting a shot or getting the vaccine. Or nurses, or somebody gets this, or someone has anaphylactic shock, or whatever happens to be over and over again. And that's because we actually don't know the true extent of the negatives of any of these vaccines. And we'll find out by, like I said, like June, July, by the time we get through all of these vaccination cases, we'll know, because we're going to have 80 million people who have all tested the vaccine from Moderna and Pfizer.
And there are going to be expected outliers that have significant side effects. That's how medicine works. This is being rolled out at a mass level. Trials aren't necessarily going to uncover every single thing, but there is a general observable incident rate that is perhaps not reflected in the literature published along with vaccines. Bell's palsy is interesting because it's been thought to be caused by a virus. And with the increase in social distancing, the spread of various viruses like the flu, there's been under 1,500 flu cases in the entire United States.
Which is crazy.
The flu is effectively non-existent due to social distancing. And you're going to see a similar effect with Bell's palsy. If it is, in fact, caused by a virus, which has been one of the theories. So the prevalence of Bell's palsy within the two trials of both Moderna and Pfizer, where the vaccine group had a higher incident rate, could simply be that a inflammatory response in some way, shape, or form causes Bell's palsy. And you're seeing a lower rate in the general population because of social distancing, reducing the amount of the virus spread and reducing the number of inflammatory responses. So it could be that Bell's palsy is not caused by the vaccine in terms of the contents of the vaccine. It could be that Bell's palsy is simply caused by injecting any foreign substance into your body and causing an inflammatory response. And I think we're going to see a large number of medical studies determining what the underlying cause of certain things are based on social distancing, reducing the spread and interaction of various human-borne illness.
All I know is I'm going to keep wearing a mask.
Are you going to double mask? Because that's what the cool kids are doing now.
I'm going to double mask. I might even triple mask. I mean, you might be cool, but you're not seven pop collars cool. Like, you might be cool, but you're not seven masks cool. It's 65%, right, efficacy on a mask?
On a cotton-based, like, three-layer mask?
Three-layer non-surgical mask, right? Without the plastic on it and without maybe any of the static influencers. So then if you were to double that up, is it a stacking? So now you have a non-linear permeability check between the two layers? I mean, I don't know why Fauci would say that, or Fauci, or fuckface. I don't know why he would say that, because nobody wears a mask, right? So I have no idea if putting two masks on would strain, like, would increase additional pathways to breathe through.
It seems to me like the whole push for double masking is really trying to increase the correctness by which people wear a mask. So you have two on, it covers more of your face, it's tighter. You might get a better seal or a better environmental kind of airlock around your face, whereas people wear it under their nose and that does nothing. What I don't really understand is why isn't everybody in the U.S. just shipped like 7 N95 masks once a week?
Didn't China give us like 100 billion masks?
It's some insane amount of masks China has produced and shipped to the U.S. But they're KN95 masks.
Which is arguably the same thing as the N95 mask.
Yes.
Except that it has maybe a smaller face because of the stereotypically smaller bodied, framed bodies of the Asian population over there. And that's true. I can't tell you how I know that with mask manufacturing, but I do know that different regions of the world have different sized masks because of face sizes. What I do know also is that there is no real difference between the N95 and KN95 standards, besides some nuances that you wouldn't understand unless you're into particulate filtration.
So everybody in the U.S. should be shipped a KN or N95 mask, and you should just wear it. We don't need to be doing this double masking thing. It would be a much better public messaging to say everybody in the U.S. will receive a package in the mail with N95 masks once a week. Wear them.
I think it's something else. I think there should be two things that happen. I think they should take and they rephrase the no shoes, no shirt, no service statement. No shoes, no shirt, no mask, no service. Like, just make it a stupid mantra, right? Just take the mantra, repeat the mantra 100,000 times, right? No mask, no service, whatever it needs to be, just from a public propaganda, that's all it is. The second is, it's kind of like, I think, setting the bar higher so that the minimum doesn't seem so ridiculous.
I'm supposed to wear two masks, but I'm only going to wear one because fuck the government.
Yeah, fuck the government. I don't want their bullshit mask. Yeah, fuck you. Like, I don't understand. It'd be like saying, like, in order to be on the Hall of Fame, instead of you being at 300, you need to be at 333 or 350 in baseball. I don't know baseball. Eat shit. I know Hank Aaron just died.
Current events topic, there was nobody elected to the Hall of Fame this year because everybody did steroids, apparently.
I don't fucking care. It's entertainment. Who gives a shit? You know, hitting 500 home runs and 300 lifetime batting average and all these nonsensical terms make people strive to be better because they're never going to achieve that and get that. So saying, like, okay, I'm going to have two masks on, bitch, means that majority of the population may just wear one mask.
Whereas they wore zero previously.
Yeah. And two masks also get rid of people wearing gaiters, which is dumb.
They're totally useless.
Yeah. It's like, just put your t-shirt over your face. It's the same thing. It's the same material. It literally actually has a less weave than your shirt does. Your cotton shirt has a tighter weave than most gaiters do because you stretch a gaiter, and the gaiter is a polymer base, which means that it doesn't have to hold the structure together like cotton does. It'll come open. It's so dumb.
You're literally wearing a completely permeable mesh shield when you wear a gaiter that has no COVID blocking properties.
No. The reason why the N95s work so well is because they generally have a static in them, a static polymer that things attach to, like a magnet. So I won't go into like the electric double layer. I won't get into some bonding and some other stuff like that. But particles that are 3.3 microns or 300 nanometers, right? That's the number. 0.3 microns, 300 nanometers is smaller than the wavelength of blue light.
So you don't want to be able to see through your mask.
Yes. You should. Like, if you can see yellow through your mask or red, that means you have 600 nanometer pores or bigger. You're past the diffraction limit of a certain wavelength. So that means, like, UV can come through your mask maybe at 300. 365 is the onslaught of UV. So we're talking about UVC levels at 300. Just know that the viruses that are being pulled in there are smaller than wavelengths of light, which makes it actually pretty cool technology. Yes. Yeah, so now we have this interesting intersection in which we have, let's say, the five largest countries that have vaccines out there. So we have Russia, we had the Chinese, we have two coming from the U.S., we had the one that came from Oxford, right? The, I forget the name of that one coming out of
AstraZeneca.
The UK. AstraZeneca, right? We had the Merck one that was just shelved. So we have multiple countries all competing. And each one of those is essentially competing for customers in its own way. Guaranteed money. So Pfizer wants customers, are going to try to convince the U.S. government to make the number one choice. They're also going to have other countries pick them up too because the U.S. wants it and you're a trading partner with the U.S., please take ours. Where there's other people that need it too, like you have the African nations, you have India, which is basically an impoverished second world country maybe. So they have manufacturing and resources, but they don't have centralized enough resources to be able to give money to private industry in handouts to vaccinate. They basically need free vaccinations is what they need. They had the ability to make them. They don't have the ability to pay for them. So you're seeing people like Russia saying, you want a recipe? Here, take it. Or you want CoronaVac from China? Take it. So you have this other incentive where just giving the vaccine to another country means that you may actually have the dominant share because you'll have multiple people manufacturing it and injecting it and testing it. And you may find out that quickly whether or not you're winning or losing based on the fact that you can get them out to more people. If you need two shots and you have the ability to make it, you're going to win just from the sheer fact that you can get the shots out. You can do the make. And if you have another country making it for you, like India, if you're China, you can. That means that you guys can share resources back and forth in order to help the deficits in your vaccine, depending on who your manufacturers are. But if you only have one manufacturing site or two that are monopolized for your production, at the end of the day, if something goes wrong with your production, you've screwed the entire pipeline and supply chain.
And this is going to happen in the U.S., where you have the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccine, and nobody else is really producing these. So there's a situation where the U.S. has done a first wave of round one, and now we're having production issues. And you can't just pull in another vaccine because you've already got the first dose of another one. You're not supposed to mix them.
That's not how it works.
It's not
motor oil.
And so you have a population that's effectively stuck on needing a second dose of a very specific vaccine that is not globally manufactured and is not widely available. You're bottled in by production limits, not logistical problems. So China, India, and Russia appear to be solving this problem by saying, we want to manufacture our drugs across the world in as large a volume as possible. Where the U.S. is effectively saying, we want to do that too, but we're not going to share our recipe with anybody. So it only will be done in the U.S.
And that just means that you've exchanged capital, money to capital, public handout, because your insurance provider is going to pay for it, or the U.S. government's going to pay for it. Your tax money will go to a private company to make a vaccine that not everybody's going to get. So they've basically exchanged out, you know, these profits for your stability, for your health and your safety. Because instead of them giving out the formulation and making everybody produce it that can produce it, you've ended up with a single supplier problem. And anybody that's in manufacturing or retail or anywhere know that you don't ever want single supplier. Because the single supplier will fuck you over. They may do things like, we overfilled our vials, so there's an extra dose, and now you owe us money for the extra dose. Even though we shipped you the extra dose, you owe us money. It'd be like McDonald's stopping in your drive-thru and saying things like, we gave you 3 extra fries, so now you owe us 5 cents more for those 3 extra fries. What the hell? I bought that. You gave me the volume. You gave me what it was supposed to be. You shipped it to me. I don't owe you anymore. But now Pfizer's going to ask for that money back. Or at least say, well, we're not going to give you as much now because you already got the 6th dose. You wanted 100 million. Well, we already gave you extra doses, so why would you give me more vials? Which is insane. I mean, that's just incredibly insane position to be in.
This is a real thing that happened where Pfizer fills their vials with, let's say, 100 units of liquid volume, and each injection needs to be, let's say, 20. So there's 5 in a vial based on pure volumes. But the syringe has waste. You plunge the syringe into the bottle. You slurp up some of the volume. You inject it. There's still vaccine left in the syringe. Now, foreign countries, they all have different syringes. There are a bunch of different syringe designs. You can buy vials with different profiles to limit the amount of volume that's lost as part of the syringe. You can buy different syringe designs that have less waste. But all of this needs to be pre-calculated. So if you're buying vials from Pfizer and you anticipate that based on the syringes that you have available, you're going to get X number of doses. And Pfizer's like, well, we're presuming you have a certain syringe, which means you can get this number of doses. Then we're only going to send X number of vials. So there's like a whole separate layer of logistical problems enforced by the syringe and whether the vials were under or overfilled or how much was in each syringe. You can't do stuff like mix vials either. So there's just very basic problems associated with the distribution of these that were in no way, shape, or form really ironed out, and Pfizer just wants their money.
They want more money, as much money as possible. I mean, some of the biggest makers on this are, you know, the vial companies, probably the syringe companies like BD, right? Just making hand over fist and making specially designed things. The other thing that Pfizer can do is say, you need less per shot now. They could say, well, instead of 20, you can use 15. Well, guess what? 15 is now goes into 100 like 6 times instead of 5 times. Now there's additional shots sitting around and they can charge you for it. And this is exactly what they're doing time and time again. They're screwing you over. And again, it doesn't matter if it's Democrat or Republican. Congress has sold you to capital because that's what the neoliberalism is. It's basically democratically elected fascism. They want the corporations in control, and they actually don't care whether or not you care.
For future episodes and to learn more about the worker movement, join us at workermovement.com.